True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Try to help me wake this baby up. There's something terribly wrong.
She dropped the one-year-old off at Stephanie Spurgeon's home at 6:45 in the morning. It was the first time the baby would be in daycare away from her grandmother and young mother, Esther. Around 2:45 p.m., Patricia drove back to the home daycare. Her granddaughter looked like she was sleeping, but Patricia says she was on her stomach. Not typical.
Stephanie Spurgeon bent over, telling the witness, Patricia, that the reason she didn't wake up was because she played hard with the other kids and she was probably just tuckered out.
Patricia drove home with Maria and then panicked. She screamed for Esther, who had just gotten home from school, to open the door.
I saw Maria very limp. It was almost like a bag of rice.
Baby's in trouble. She needs help.
I begged her to wake up, but she would never wake up.
Doctors who treated the baby say Maria had a swollen brain. Prosecutors believe Spurgeon shook the child and ultimately killed her. But defense attorneys say the state can't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
I'm excited to tell you that today's episode is sponsored by Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, a darkly comedic drama from Academy Award winner Martin McDonagh, writer and director of In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths, among other projects. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is a uniquely entertaining tale of revenge and redemption with some of the best actors of our time, Academy Award winners Frances McDormand and Woody Harrelson, as well as Sam Rockwell and Peter Dinklage. It's playing in select theaters now, and I highly recommend that you see it. In-home daycare settings allow caretakers to work from home while offering working mothers an alternative to traditional daycare settings. Parents weigh the benefits and the drawbacks of their daycare options, and most are satisfied with the care that their children receive. When a tragedy occurs, as it did with the death of one-year-old Maria Harris, the situation is reassessed in hindsight and in grief. Maria was the adored child of her teenage mother, Esther, both of them living in the supportive environment of her grandparents. It was Esther's determination to provide a better life for her daughter that led her to place Maria in Stephanie Spurgeon's in-home daycare. On August 21, 2008, Maria's grandmother, Patricia Harris, picked up Maria from her first day in Stephanie's home. She left with Maria in her arms and a foreboding sense that something wasn't right. Maria was in too deep a sleep, heavy and limp, like a sack of sand. She didn't rouse as she was buckled into her car seat. Her eyes did not open, and her head lulled to one side. Maria would never again regain consciousness. 1 week later, Maria was removed from life support, and several of her tiny organs were donated to children who needed them. The Harris family was living in a nightmare, and Stephanie Spurgeon would face a trial for the murder of little Maria Harris. At the quiet end today, Dick and I are talking about the injuries that caused Maria Harris's death, as well as the law applied to her case. Shaken baby syndrome, also known as abusive head trauma, is a topic spurring debate and strong emotion, of course. In Death in a Home Daycare, we hope to shed some light on recent controversies and provide some insight on prevention. This is a very tough topic, Dick, so I hope you've brought a strong brew for us.
I have, and this is a very difficult emotional topic.
Absolutely.
So the beer I got today is Leon, which is an English barley wine brewed by Cigar City Brewing in Tampa. I've reviewed a bunch of Cigar City beers. Now, barley wines are these nice, really strong beers, fruity, alcoholic, pretty strong. This is the more refined one, the English barley wine style, so it's a little more balanced and less rip-your-throat-out type of drink.
Well, that's good.
It is.
I hate when my throat gets ripped out.
Well, some of those can. It's a 13% alcohol by volume, so it's a heavy hitter.
All right,
which
good.
You asked for.
I did.
And it is aged in brandy barrels. That makes it a very interesting beer. So on to Leon. It's a murky brown color, pretty still, little to no carbonation. And that's part of the style, so it's not a detraction. It has a nice brandy and sweet fruit aroma. Then when you get into the taste, you got grapes, prunes, raisins, and some toffee. Wonderful beer. It's a very sticky beer. Kind of coats your tongue.
Mm.
Fun to drink.
Sounds like fun.
And the alcohol will certainly warm you up.
Very good.
So this is one that we will share. I don't think I could make it through an entire big bottle by myself.
Well, not and talk through a podcast at the same time, for sure.
Probably not. So let's do it.
All right, let's open it up.
Hey, did you see the sign down there at the quiet end?
No, what sign? A new sign?
The sign that says Black Friday coming up.
Oh, yeah. But why does the bar care? Are they having sales or something?
No, it's not that Black Friday.
What do you mean?
It's Black Friday in the bar, which means that it's going to be dark beer day. So stouts, porters, black beers. Black Friday.
That's like Dick Heaven.
Isn't it? Are we going?
That sounds like a porn film, doesn't it?
Dick Heaven? It does.
Yeah, I'll go with you.
Oh,
sure.
Good. Because there's going to be some good beers.
I bet. Yeah. Sounds good. But right now, let's just walk on down to the quiet end and do our podcast.
Okay.
All right. You can go ahead and start our story.
So the story starts when Esther Harris was 15 years old, and she went on a summer trip with her mom, Pat, to Chambersburg, Virginia. Now, the family had lived in Chambersburg before moving to Florida, and they're happy to go for a visit and get out of that nice, hot, humid Florida summer. School year was over. Esther just finished the 10th grade, and she was looking forward to her 16th birthday. Chambersburg is west of Gettysburg. It's a small town with an influx of growth that included fast food chains and strip malls. Yeah, typical. Near the end of their trip, Esther and her mother visited a local mall, and Pat decided to get her hair done. So Esther took this opportunity to do some window shopping. And she couldn't believe her luck when she was approached by a handsome 21-year-old named Benito. And he made Esther feel special when he started a conversation with her, because Esther was a bit on the chubby side and a little bit shy, and she'd never, ever had a boyfriend. Benito had this beautiful smile, white teeth, couldn't keep his eyes off of her. They talked for only an hour or so, and Esther gave him her phone number. But she doubted she'd ever hear from him again, because she's just visiting there.
And she's a child.
And she's a child, and he's an adult.
Right. But Esther did hear from Benito a few weeks later. He'd actually moved to Florida just to be near her. So if she'd been older and more experienced, she probably would have seen this as odd or even creepy. But Esther was young, and she was flattered.
I would see it as creepy.
Yes, but she's a 15-year-old girl.
Right. She's in love.
Well,
already.
Already. Now, Pat was back working as a home health aide, caring for elderly people in their own homes. Now, sometimes she'd be gone for 12 hours a day, bathing, feeding, dressing, giving medications, doing laundry, just about everything. So she'd go really above and beyond what her job required because she was very compassionate towards people. Now, sometimes they had no one else to depend on but her, so Pat didn't like to miss any time at work. Now, during the summer months, Esther was the one responsible for keeping the house clean and doing the household chores. The Harrises had a Florida-style home, a nice little home with a manicured yard and an enclosed swimming pool. It was very clean and tidy. Esther did a good job on housework.
Yeah, those are nice homes.
Yeah.
They're not huge. They all have pools.
That's right. Right? Yeah, right. Now, Esther's parents weren't happy when they met Benito, as you can imagine. She's not even 16 yet, and he's 21, and they didn't even know if he was in the country legally. He didn't have a steady job, and he seemed kind of obsessed with Esther. It wasn't long before Esther and Benito were in love and started talking about getting married, which really freaked her parents out.
Oh, yes. So Benito came over one day after Esther's birthday, her 16th birthday, and he wanted to take her out to dinner. Now, Pat insisted on going along. Pat and Esther's father, Clyde, were concerned because Esther is way too young to get married, and they wanted to slow things down between their daughter and Benito. His English was not very good. Communication was difficult. And he had trouble looking the parents in the eye when they spoke to him. That made them suspicious of his intentions.
This
must have been a difficult meal. Here's a kid whose second language is poor English. I'm sure he's nervous about being with the parents.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be difficult.
Well, I think they were more patient about it than I would have been if it was my daughter.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
Right.
So the Harrises decided that Esther and Benito should never be alone together until Esther got older. That's a wise decision.
That's a good idea. Don't the Amish do that when their kids are dating? They always have to be supervised.
Gotta have chaperones.
Yeah.
So they decided that Esther was not allowed to see him anywhere except in her home when one or both of her parents were there.
I think that's pretty generous of them, actually.
Yeah. It's not like you can't see him.
Right.
It's that you can only see him with one of us present.
Well, you know that whole you can't see him thing never works anyway.
Well, that just intensifies things.
They were wise to avoid that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But constantly supervising a 16-year-old is difficult. Shortly after that, Esther found herself home alone in the evening. There was an intense thunderstorm starting up suddenly, and she was afraid. So she called her boyfriend, Benito, for someone to talk to. Well, he learned that she was home alone and decided to come over. So the two ended up having sex, and Esther would say it only took this one time for her to get pregnant. They didn't use birth control, so it's not a huge surprise that that could have happened.
Well, it only takes one, right?
That's right. So when Esther told him that she was pregnant, Benito suggested that she have an abortion. And she was raised in a Christian home. They were quite religious.
Very religious.
And she'd never consider such an option, so she was angry and her feelings were hurt when he said that.
Yeah, so plan B, if you won't have an abortion, then let's get married. So that flew really well with the parents. Esther's parents would not give permission. And anyway, Benito didn't have the correct paperwork to get married because he was in the United States illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And marrying Esther wouldn't automatically make him a citizen. So he could be forced to leave the country at any time for any reason. So Esther finally decided that despite Benito's continued pleas for their marriage, she wanted to see how he behaved around Maria. That's the name that they are going to give the baby.
Right.
After she was born, before she considered marrying him.
That seems very mature.
So it's like we're taking a test drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to make sure he'd make a good father. The two of them went to counseling with the Harris's pastor. He said that people don't get married just because there's a pregnancy.
So kind of a progressive pastor.
Yeah, because most of them would say, well, you got to get married, you're pregnant.
You would think so.
Right? So at first, Esther's father didn't agree. He felt that she should marry because she had shamed the family. There, that's more like it. That's
what,
that old-time
more of what
religion.
You expected.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, Benito wanted Esther to quit school since he had only gone through the 10th grade, and he thought he was doing fine.
Wow.
Well, not that we could tell, anyway.
Doesn't seem like it. And
no.
She decided to stay in school, so we give her credit for that. She wanted to be educated and provide a good life for her child, so good for her. Now, Benito had been nice to her during her pregnancy, but she could sense he was afraid to be a father. They had cultural differences, too. In addition to his inability to communicate well in English and Esther's lack of ability in conversing in Spanish, he thought babies should sleep in the same bed with their mothers, not in a crib. And that was just one of the differing opinions they had right away about raising a baby. Now, he also didn't believe in settling down and having a home in one place. His brothers and his cousins had worked in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Florida. They did farming, maintenance, and worked on assembly lines in factories. And when they got tired of a job or got laid off, they simply moved on. There was no real consistency in their life.
No. I mean, they're kind of like migrant workers, right?
Yeah, almost like gypsies, right?
Yeah.
But Esther did not want that kind of life for her child. I mean, she'd been raised very conservatively by her parents.
Right. She wasn't raised that way.
No.
So she wants a home, a job, a family.
Absolutely.
Right. Not moving all over the country.
Right. So it really didn't look good to her when Benito lost his job and stayed out of work for 3 whole months.
No, that's a little tough, isn't it?
He probably should have been working and putting money towards the care of the baby, is what she thought. But he wasn't really lazy. He could find work if he wanted to, but he didn't seem to have the responsibility or the priorities that he needed to be a family man.
No, he didn't. So the baby's born, everyone's happy, but Benito left the state of Florida and returned to Pennsylvania to be with his brother. He's gone. Wow. He talked on the phone with Esther, but they usually ended up arguing. He eventually did return with some friends when Maria was about 9 months old, but he didn't come back to be near Esther and Maria. Instead, he went to a town in central Florida, and there, on the Gulf Coast, the Harrises, he borrowed a car and came to see Maria. He spent less than 2 hours with her and then left again, saying that he needed to return the car to his friend. Wow. And yeah. It took him 9 months to even see the baby.
Yeah, so he didn't really pass that test. So Esther's disappointed, but not totally surprised by his behavior. And she said that he seemed afraid of being a father, and she wasn't sure if he would be able to handle it. She actually felt a sense of relief that he was out of the picture, and now she could concentrate on just being a good mom to Maria. Patricia was proud of her daughter for not rushing into a bad marriage. She admired how Esther had carefully thought the situation through, and she hadn't let her emotions get in the way, in spite of her young age. Now, Clyde was especially glad that things had worked out the way they had, and he was able to soften his attitude with his daughter. He kind of saw the error in his thinking, trying to get her married off right away with someone who wasn't going to work out anyway. Plus, he was already forming a deep bond with his granddaughter. He didn't want to let her out of his sight when he got home from work. It just added a lot of joy to their lives to have this little girl.
It sounds like they did.
Yeah, and she got a lot of attention. Now, before Maria's birth, Benito had been only off and on with Esther anyway, and that kind of helped her to reach her decision that it just wasn't going to work out. She didn't know if he really loved her or ever had, and she was beginning to realize how young she was, and she wasn't really able to handle a serious relationship at this young age.
Yes, but you're never too young to enjoy meals made with Spice Island spices. When you're cooking meals for the family this holiday season, be sure to opt for premium spices from Spice Islands. Take today's beer, Leon. It goes great with our typical pre-Thanksgiving dinner of Indian food. Something about a barley wine and Spice Islands curry powder that just makes it all happen. Now, by sun-drying many of their spices and de-stemming their chili peppers by hand, Spice Islands uses a craft approach to deliver the most authentic and intense flavor possible. They maintain a strict standard for each item to ensure consistency, quality, and flavor. And they take extra steps to ensure the richness of their flavors, like cryogenically freezing their cumin to preserve its oils, or milling their garlic to a true powder so it doesn't add grittiness to your dishes. So whether you're looking for flavor adventure or simply better tasting meals, fill your pantry with Spice Islands and taste the difference in every bottle. Visit spiceislands.com/brewery for more spice facts and delicious recipes. That's spiceislands.com/brewery. And pick up Spice Island spices in the premium spice section of your local retailer.
Okay, and I want to talk for a minute about the new movie with one of my favorite actresses, Academy Award winner Frances McDormand.
You're just in love with Frances.
I am. The movie is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Now, it's the winner of the Best Screenplay Award at the Venice Film Festival, the Audience Award at the Toronto International Film Festival, and the San Diego Film Festival. Writer and director Martin McDonagh is also an Academy Award winner for In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. With an impressive ensemble cast including Frances, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, and Peter Dinklage, it's a hit with critics and with audiences. Frances McDormand's character Mildred lost her teenage daughter Angela when the girl was raped and killed. So Mildred puts up billboards as an attack against the police who haven't solved her daughter's murder. But this isn't just a statement against police complacency. Variety calls it a quirky emotional puzzle put together by a trickster poet. Now, I drove over an hour to see it, and it was well worth it. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes with a 95% score. Now, that's rare. That hardly ever happens. And you can see it now in select theaters. So if you're lucky enough to live in a big city where they have it now, go see it. And for the rest of us small town folk, you either have to drive a ways or just wait and it'll show up in your town. But it really is a great movie.
Worth the wait.
Absolutely. Now, after Benito left this time, Esther contacted him to let him know she wanted his rights as Maria's father taken away. He agreed, allowing Maria to be strictly Esther's child, and if something should happen to Esther, then Maria would stay with her grandparents, Pat and Clyde. She didn't know Benito and his family. In fact, Benito's own mother, who lived in Mexico, didn't even know she had a granddaughter. Benito said he'd signed the papers surrendering his rights. So Pat and Esther took little Maria up to Pennsylvania to meet him, and he signed them no problem. They wanted him to see his daughter again, though. It was July of 2008, Maria was 11 months old, and no one knew that it would be the last time he would ever see her. So I think that was nice of them to take her with them so he could see her.
Yeah, well, I think they're trying to do the right thing, in a sense.
Yeah.
They're asking for a lot from him to give up parental rights.
Well, I don't think they knew it would be the last time, right?
Well, it'd be the last time he would see her, probably.
Well,
because they are terminating his rights. They don't want him around there.
Well, maybe. It kind of sounded to me like they might let him visit later. Or when she was an adult, she may have gone looking for him. But either way, I think they really were smart to get him to sign the papers, because if anything did happen to Esther, they certainly wouldn't want the baby to go off with him.
Right. Although, as we find out, it's a moot point. Because Benito was in the country illegally, which Esther suspected. And she called an attorney after this is all done with the signing and stuff. And she was told that Benito had no rights to Maria anyway, because he had never asked for a paternity test to declare himself as the father. So this meant that he could never claim her as his own if something were to happen to Esther. And the papers they had him sign were meaningless.
Okay.
So it's all a moot point.
Sure.
As it turns out. The other thing was, because Esther was 16 and Benito was 22, her parents thought about having him arrested for statutory rape. Now, Clyde, the father, wanted Benito arrested and thrown in jail. But the wife, Pat, protested. She said that Maria would grow up resenting him for doing this to her father. And she wanted him to prove that he would not be a father by his own volition, which he did.
Yeah, that's true.
None of the Harrises knew that Florida law would not have ruled the relationship and resulting pregnancy as statutory rape, since Florida law states that as long as both parties are within the age range of 16 to 23 and it was consensual, then it's not considered statutory rape.
I thought statutory rape was always consensual. That's why it was called statutory instead of just out-and-out rape.
That's true.
Yeah. But since Benito took off anyway, Maria would have known that her father didn't want her in his life, which isn't good. So Clyde wouldn't have caused that. So in the end, it all worked out for Esther and her family because they had Maria to themselves.
Right. And they didn't have to worry about Benito coming and trying to take the baby away or doing anything.
Right.
So, So on August 10th, 2008, Maria Harris turned 1 year old. 4 days later, she had an appointment with her doctor, Dr. McCormick, for her one-year-old well-baby checkup.
Right. Then a week later, on the 21st, she was going to start her new daycare. Esther had to attend school herself, so she arose at 4 a.m. She got Maria out of bed and played with her for a while. Then at 5 a.m., Esther prepared a breakfast of oatmeal for her. Now Pat, Maria, and Esther got in the car and first went to Esther's bus stop, where they had to wait for the bus. Maria wanted to get out of the car. Esther left on the bus. Pat left to take Maria to the Spurgeon home daycare. Now, she carried Maria into the house and, after a period of time, handed her off to Stephanie Spurgeon. Pat stepped out of that door between 6:45 and 7 a.m., leaving her at the daycare. Now, at 10 a.m., Pat called to check in, and Maria got on the phone. She was whiny, but she seemed pretty normal. At noon, Esther called to check on Maria. Stephanie said that Maria was taking a nap. So this is a critical point because it can be determined approximately how long Maria was asleep, since Pat picked her up at 2:45. So this was at noon. At 2:45, she gets picked up. She's still asleep, so that's almost 3 hours, which is kind of a long nap for a one-year-old.
That's a long nap.
Sure is.
So when she went to pick up Maria at the daycare, she talked with Stephanie Spurgeon. for a while. Maria was lying on her stomach, which she always slept on her back. And her pacifier was not in her mouth. And she always has the passy in her mouth. And she was in the pack-and-play bed, sideways, instead of aligned the way it should be. So these are things that sort of set off maybe not exactly alarm bells, but they were out of the ordinary.
Yeah, it was just a little weird, I guess.
It was.
Yeah.
Now, so she gets picked up and she doesn't wake up while Pat and Stephanie are talking right there in the same room with her. And after being asleep for at least 2 hours and 45 minutes, Stephanie told Pat that Maria did not wake up because she'd played hard and was all tuckered out. So Stephanie then picked her up and she still didn't waken. Pat didn't think much of this at the time, however.
So this is Maria's first day in daycare when Patricia picks her up, and she knows something just isn't quite right because she didn't move when Stephanie picked her up, so Maria felt limp and heavy. Stephanie said she'd been busy. As Pat drove off, her anxiety, though, was beginning to build because she had a bad feeling. Maria's car seat was directly behind the driver's seat, so she couldn't lay eyes on her as she drove. So she's getting nervous, and she starts, you know, calling out, "Wake up, baby girl, Maria, are you all right?" she said, and she's raising her voice, getting more and more nervous, but there's no sound from the back seat. So her heart's starting to race, she's starting to feel a little panicky.
Yeah, something's wrong.
Yeah. Then she hears this gurgling noise and a cough, and she wonders, oh my God, should I pull over and check on her? But there didn't seem to be anywhere to pull over. It was a busy, narrow, two-lane road. So she was only a few blocks from home, so she just raced home in a state of panic. When she turned down the street to her house, Esther was home, and Pat pulled into the driveway, crying and yelling. She jumped out of the car, threw open the back door. She reached in and unstrapped Maria. She noticed that Maria had vomited a little bit on her top, and her head was sagging unnaturally down toward her chest. She yelled for Esther as she ran to the front door with Maria still hanging limp in her arms. So she's calling for Esther to come out and telling her something's wrong with Maria. So I just can't imagine the panic she's feeling.
Oh, here's this unresponsive baby.
Yeah.
Well, a few hours earlier, she was a nice, alert, happy one-year-old.
I know. And isn't it just crazy that this was her first day in daycare?
First day in daycare.
This is just every parent's nightmare.
Absolutely. So Esther comes out. Pat tells her that Maria would not wake up. They made a 911 call. I think it was Esther. Made a 911 call. 319 or 320, somewhere around there. Help me, something is wrong with my baby. Emergency personnel arrived at 3:26 p.m. They found Maria, who was not breathing, according to Esther, in Esther's arms. They started resuscitation and put her in the ambulance. Two sets of paramedics had arrived, those with Sunstar, an ambulance company, and the county paramedics. They left for the hospital at 3:34, so they weren't there very long. They recognized that they needed to get this critically ill kid to the hospital.
I know. I shouldn't do these stories, should I? I'll talk for a while. The ambulance transported her to Meese Countryside Hospital in Safety Harbor. During the drive, they put her on an IV. Her eyes were glazed over when a paramedic opened her lids to look at them. They checked her blood sugar and prepared her for this 10-minute ride to the hospital. Now, according to the paramedic, Maria had cried out periodically in the ambulance. Her blood glucose, blood sugar, was 468, which is super high, and there was acetone and ketones in her urine. Now, an hour after at the hospital, her glucose level had dropped to 363, and then it did eventually stabilize.
Right, and from what we can glean from records, she wasn't treated for diabetes. It just came down with IV fluids.
Mm-hmm. So what caused that high blood sugar in a normal baby?
Well, the trauma, the stress. So a lot of adrenaline going on and causes release of sugar. So I don't think she had diabetes in the sense that the blood sugar was stabilized pretty easily without a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the local hospital. The ER physician ordered a CT scan of the brain and examined Maria. He called All Children's Hospital in St. Pete to arrange to have Maria transferred there. They needed to have a specialist look at her. The CT scan showed that she had a subdural hematoma, but no skull fracture. But she was critically ill. These subdurals are very horrible things. They can cause death.
Do you want to explain exactly what it is?
Sure.
You can do it at this point, or?
I can do it. So a subdural hematoma, the dura is one of the membranes covering the brain, and there's veins and blood vessels in the area. So if you have a bleed underneath the layer of the dura, it's called a subdural hematoma. So the skull on the outside, then the next layer is the dura, then there's a couple more layers, then you're down to the brain itself. So she had a bleed underneath the dura, and it's a slow bleed because it's a venous bleed. It's not arterial, so it's not pumping out blood. It's just kind of oozing blood. And what's happening is that it's putting pressure on the brain because it's taking up space. And the brain's in a closed space, right? It's in a skull.
Yeah, so when it puts pressure on the brain like that, is it actually killing parts of the brain off?
It's doing a couple things. It's killing cells off because they're unable to get a blood supply. It's also pushing the brain, because it's taking up space, it's pushing the brain downward through the opening at the base of the skull, called the foramen magnum. So what happens there is, it's called herniating the brainstem. That causes you to stop breathing, basically, because the respiratory center's there. And this kid needed to be ventilated. She couldn't breathe on her own. It can cause seizures, which she had. So it's a critical situation.
Okay, now when they say massive edema?
Swelling.
And the swelling is from?
Well, there's no blood flow. So you're lacking oxygen, and that causes cell death and fluid buildup,
okay.
Swelling. So the medical term for all that is anoxic encephalopathy, which just means brain damage because of lack of oxygen.
So this injury was serious enough to lead to unconsciousness right after it occurred, and she never became conscious again. Is there any way with this type of injury that it could have happened the night before and then just kind of gotten worse, and then she ended up being unresponsive that day?
Absolutely no way. And I know the defense tried to paint it as it could have happened earlier, and they wanted it to be more of a chronic subdural hematoma that would indicate less of a bleed, and then there's some acute event that made it re-bleed all this. But no, this is an injury that can be incompatible with life, and it certainly was in Maria's case. So it's not something that you're going to have a nice, normal kid when there's already a bleed. This is a... It happens, the event happens, the bleeding occurs, and you rapidly lose consciousness.
So, let's just say if the babysitter threw Maria at noon, when she said she had started her nap, right?
Right.
And she'd laid there till 2:45 unconscious. Could something have been done during that time that may have saved her?
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's always tough to be a Monday morning quarterback. But if the first thing would, you'd have to recognize that you might have harmed the child, which wasn't the case, right?
Well, I guess not. I mean, is this something this woman did before? There's a lot of questions surrounding that. I don't know.
Well, there was a report that it had happened before with a child in her care.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Not to this extent.
Not to this extent.
That child survived, but she was seen by this baby's sister, older sister, being rough with the baby. Shaking her and throwing her into the pack and play or under a bed or something. And that child survived.
Mm-hmm.
So she must not have had as severe an injury. But Maria was injured critically and needed immediate attention. Because you can. I mean, if you identify it quickly and take her to surgery and evacuate the hematoma and stop the bleeding, you can do okay or relatively okay.
Okay, so it was at 7:30 when they transferred her to All Children's Hospital, so she'd been at the other hospital for almost 4 hours. And during her ambulance ride, she had seizures, which continued once they got to that hospital. And then the next morning, they did an MRI. I guess to save money, the ER at Mies Countryside only does x-rays or CT scans, but not MRIs. Now, the MRI performed the next day at All Children's confirmed the subdural hematoma and retinal hemorrhaging from the CAT scan was also noted. So I don't think that's unusual to not do MRIs in an ER. MRIs are a big deal.
They are. And you're generally going to have them at bigger hospitals or tertiary care centers.
Especially for an infant.
Right. They'll show kind of the same thing. I mean, you can see bleeds much better on a CT scan than you can on an MRI.
Oh, that surprises me.
So they did an appropriate test. I mean, kids that come into the ER with head trauma and you suspect brain injury, a CT scan is kind of the first procedure to do. And then the MRI will be able to tell you more structural damage to the brain.
Okay, what about the retinal hemorrhaging? Do you see that on those?
You can on the CT scan.
Now, the Harrises were given a place to stay there at the Ronald McDonald House, so they were always at Maria's side. They were told that they needed to make a decision to end life support if they wanted to preserve her organs for donation. So early on, they knew that there wasn't a chance of survival. She's basically brain dead, right?
She's already brain dead, yes.
That's awful. What a tragedy.
Horrible.
So Esther tried to get Benito to come down from Pennsylvania to say goodbye to his daughter. And then he said he wanted to bring his girlfriend with him, so that just made Esther really upset, who you can imagine is very emotional right now. And she decided to stop talking to him. Now Pat continued to try and get him to come down. She talked to him late that night and told him he'd regret it if he didn't come down and see her, but he never did come. He really has no investment in her.
No.
No.
I mean, just the fact that, yeah, I'll come say goodbye. Oh, I'm bringing my girlfriend. Come on.
Yeah. So the Harris family gathered together in prayer around Maria's bedside on August 28th to say goodbye. Her little body would have to be rushed out of the room right away to prepare to remove her heart, liver, spleen, and kidneys to be kept for a transplant soon after her equipment was shut down. So this was, as you know, a very private and sad situation. And I guess they couldn't take her lungs because lungs that have been intubated that long and she had pneumonia.
She had a pneumonia. She'd been intubated for a week. I mean, it was a week from the time the injury occurred till she was declared dead. And she had some lung changes, so it precluded using her lungs to transplant.
So Esther's really gone through something that most of us couldn't handle, and she's so young.
And she's only 16.
So she's trying to go on with her life, but, you know, she's very sad. This is really hanging over her, like a black cloud, as you can imagine. Now Stephanie Spurgeon, whose children were 12 and 14 at the time, was charged with first-degree murder. The state said that Maria's injuries were caused by impact against a soft surface like a mattress. Now, the defense would point to her high glucose levels as the cause of her death.
No.
Okay.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a lot of things happening with high blood sugars and ketones, ketoacidosis, but you're not going to have central nervous system bleeds from that. The prosecution is trying to cover all the areas because they also said that she was shaken and thrown.
Yeah.
Or tossed.
Well, isn't it the shaking that causes the retinal hemorrhaging?
Yes, it is. Shaking a baby vigorously can cause bleeds, can cause retinal hemorrhages, despite some attempts of people to draw attention away from that diagnosis. I'll just say it that way.
Well, Stephanie's trial didn't begin until February of 2012, and she got out on bail until then. The prosecution's opening statement was read by attorney Brian Daniels, and he summarized what had happened to Maria by saying that she turned 1 year old on August 10th, On August 14th, she had her appointment with her pediatrician, Dr. McCormick, for a well baby checkup, and then a week later, on the 21st, she went to her new daycare. It was a brief statement, and he ended by saying that Stephanie was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, let me just insert one thing about this well baby exam. Again, the defense is putting out the possibility that diabetes was a factor in causing her death or the brain injuries. At her one-year checkup, she had been continuing to grow and develop normally. Now, if she was having early signs of diabetes, she'd be eating a lot, drinking a lot, losing weight, failing to thrive. None of that was noted by her pediatrician.
No, she had a good checkup.
So the likelihood or the possibility that she had diabetes or pre-existing diabetes, no, wasn't there.
Okay, so we're going to say no to that.
We are.
Okay.
And I'm just going to preempt the statement that it was the immunizations that she had that caused the problem.
Okay, well, okay. Let me just say what they said.
All right.
Okay, so Esther, Pat, and Clyde testified that Maria was normal that morning before going to daycare, and her pediatrician testified that on her appointment, she didn't have a complete physical, but she was on target, she was walking. Dr. McCormick explained that she had no prior injuries, no head injuries, and no problems with walking or talking. He recalled that she was playful, inquisitive, and happy, completely normal. He said that Pat and Esther were both with Maria that day, and they had good interaction with her. She walked from Esther to Pat to him, and then she sat on his lap. Now, he said he gave her an MMR, which is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and her varicella vaccine, which is chickenpox. So there were no problems with the immunizations. She didn't have any reactions. So now you can give me your spiel.
Well, it's only that the immunizations are not going to cause bleeding in the brain. That's all.
Okay.
One simple statement. And immunizations, vaccines get a lot of bad press, wrongfully so. And they're just not going to cause bleeds.
Yeah, I think that's quite far-fetched. I think most lay people even think that's pretty far-fetched.
Well, there's always true believers that you're not going to convince.
Yeah, but to cause a subdural hematoma, that doesn't even make sense.
No. The only thing that causes kids subdural hematoma in this situation, this setting, is trauma to the head.
And what do you mean in this situation?
This daycare setting. She wasn't out jumping off of buildings or anything like that. She was in daycare. They dropped off a healthy, normal one-year-old and picked up a soon-to-be brain-dead one-year-old.
Yeah, and a normal spill, like a kid that's learning to walk and hits their head on the coffee table or something. No.
No.
That wouldn't happen.
No, you need more trauma.
Now, during her testimony, Pat described how it was odd that Maria had laid across the pack and play when she picked her up that day, because she didn't really fit in that way. She said her head was turned and her mouth was open, her head was bulging through the mesh of the playpen, and her toes were pushing against the other side. In her cross-examination, Pat was asked about the distance from Spurgeon's house, and she said it was about 4 miles from where she lived. She explained the way that she went and that it took her from 12 to 15 minutes to get home. Then Pat was asked how old Esther was when Maria was born. So this is another thing they're trying to use against her, is that she's a teen mom. So they asked about Esther's treatment of Maria as a newborn. She talked about Maria's doctor's appointment on August 14th, where she had her shots. So this information would become a topic that the defense would try to use later in the trial. So we've got the vaccine that we're using, and then I don't know if they out and out said it, but they're insinuating that since she's a teen, maybe she lost her temper and injured the baby.
Well, they're trying to say that the injury must have happened at some earlier time, and it wasn't due to Stephanie Spurgeon.
Yeah.
But no. There's just no way.
And that's what the pediatric neurologist said as well. So the paramedic who worked on Maria testified that Maria wasn't acting normally. She wasn't reacting to loud noises. She wasn't alert. She only responded to painful stimuli. He explained that the treatment regimen when Maria was moved into the ambulance included oxygen, taking her blood sugar, putting a heart monitor on her, and they also gave her an IV for access. Now, Maria's breathing was noted to be within adequate range, but then she suddenly stopped breathing in the ambulance. Dr. Rodriguez, the pediatric neurosurgeon from All Children's, told the court about his neurological exam, which included cranial and motor stimulus response exams, checking to see if Maria was awake or had loss of consciousness, and looking over her imaging. He ran through his normal list of possibilities with a case like Maria's. You know, he's trying to decide, does he need to operate? What type of procedure is she going to need? Should we just watch her? But in Maria's case, she's just not responsive at all. So she's intubated. There's a machine breathing for her. She's having seizures, and her eyes deviated to the left side. So she wasn't conscious at all. He performed a cranial nerve exam and looked into her eyes for injury or elevated pressure. He observed that she had retinal hemorrhaging on both sides. So he explained that this is an injury to the retina, where vessels are broken and a bunch of red blotches are visible.
So the neurosurgeon calls in a pediatric ophthalmologist, eye doctor, to do an exam. First piece of evidence is introduced, the CT scan of Maria's brain. Dr. Rodriguez, the neurosurgeon, explained the images that were seen on the CT scan. He showed there was a thickening in the frontal area of her brain where the subdural hematoma split the two sides of her brain. This was called the false cerebrum. Blood is all along this false cerebrum. The neurosurgeon said, this is a classic picture. When veins are torn, there's a bleed along this false cerebrum. And he indicated other areas that were darker, like shadows on the photos.
So what are those areas?
Those are areas of edema, and there can be some blood too. So this is a crucial observation that was key to the state's case against Stephanie Spurgeon.
Absolutely.
Dr. Rodriguez said that her subdural hematoma was acute, which means that it happened within a short time of the taking of the CT scan. So he knew this because, as he pointed out on one of the pictures, the bleeding looked bright, like the skull. So that means it's acute and not old. It darkens up. He also explained areas that are referred to as watershed areas, and these are pathways for blood that flows through the brain from big veins to the frontal lobes. And he says there's no chance whatsoever that a kid could have walked around for a period of time after sustaining this subdural hematoma. Not due to any underlying head conditions, but due to abusive head trauma. He explained there's the nature of where the blood is and how you get that to happen. You only get this kind of head injury when these blood vessels are breached from the brain into the false cerebrum, and it's from shaking. Dr. Rodriguez, who had examined numerous pediatric victims of subdural hematomas, both acute and chronic, thus introduced the diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome.
Which, for some reason, is kind of controversial. Is
yeah.
it? I mean,
well,
it's kind of like, it's good science, the research.
It is. So I guess the diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome has been called into question by some people. And in fact, a lot of people have been found not guilty because of the concern that this is not a valid diagnosis. But I have a report that I'll be happy to read to you. It was presented at the American Academy of Pediatrics National Meeting that took place in September of this year, 2017. So while the veracity of shaken baby syndrome has been questioned in some media reports and as a courtroom defense, no controversy exists within the medical profession. Shaken baby syndrome is a diagnosis that is scientifically valid. This was a conference delivered by Sandeep Narang, MD, at the conference, at the meeting. He's the head of the Child Abuse Pediatrics Division at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. So he said there's a misperception that the medical community has shifted in its certainty over the diagnosis. He did a survey in 2016, and he found that 88% of the physicians who responded to the survey considered shaken baby syndrome to be a valid diagnosis, and 93% said abusive head trauma was a valid diagnosis. In addition, a large majority of physicians said that shaking a baby, with or without impact, was likely or highly likely to result in a subdural hematoma, severe retinal hemorrhages, coma, or death. So he believes the questions raised come from a small but vocal number of people who have been drawn to stories of possibly wrongfully convicted or wrongfully accused individuals based on a mistaken medical diagnosis.
There are a lot of those, too. If you go on the internet, there are a lot of cases of that.
But disagreements over the shaken baby syndrome diagnosis bear a large resemblance to other medical debates in which there is actually a large body of evidence supporting one side, and that side is that shaking a baby can cause damage.
Well, I think notably the defense did not have a pediatric neurologist agreeing with them testifying. I think that's quite important.
Right.
Now, the doctors did decide that homicide was the manner of death and the cause of death was abusive head trauma. Now, during the trial, 11 medical experts testified about what caused the injuries. Now, Stephanie Spurgeon's defense team countered that nobody saw their client hurt the young child, and the infant's injuries could have happened long before being dropped off. So we've already talked about that.
We've talked about that. And yes, nobody saw Spurgeon harm the child. But she just has kids there, where there weren't adults in the household during that day.
Well, no, and I think people who abuse babies like that, they don't want to be seen doing it.
Probably not.
No. I'm sure there are so many good in-home daycares, but these kind of stories would lead me to want to use a large daycare where they have cameras. There's many nowadays where you can go on your computer and watch.
And keep track.
It's sad, but I think that's where we're headed as far as feeling comfortable leaving our kids with somebody. So Stephanie Spurgeon was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 15 years in prison.
Right. The judge judge allowed a manslaughter conviction to be added to the list. Initially, it was a first-degree murder charge, but then the judge said, you can consider manslaughter also.
I don't know. I think when you do something like that, I guess she was doing something that she knew could kill her, and that's kind of what manslaughter is. She wasn't setting out to, I want to kill her.
Right.
Is that the difference there?
I guess. I mean, I just think first-degree murder with a sentence of life in prison would have been a difficult conviction.
Yes, definitely. Well, a lot of people support her and don't even think she should be in for the 15 years.
I know. But that's just denying the truth to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you knew this woman for years and she took care of your kids and everything, it would be hard to believe.
I guess it would be.
You know, that she's like this normal, nice woman to people.
But there's just absolutely no other explanation.
Yeah, I understand.
For what happened to this baby.
So what about preventing this? I mean, I know we have the Don't Shake Jake. We have the period of purple crying,
which is basically put the baby in the crib and walk away.
Yeah.
Don't lose your temper.
Sure.
And the Centers for Disease Control has created a technical package which gives a group of strategies based on the best available evidence to help prevent child abuse and neglect. These strategies include strengthening economic supports to families, changing social norms to support parents and positive parenting, providing quality care and education early in life. So those are admirable goals.
Well, and these are
things to achieve.
These are things that other countries do a lot better at than we do.
Yeah.
You know, you have to value the family and value children in order to really be behind this, which our country has really fallen short on.
Don't get me started.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you look at the Netherlands or New Zealand, I mean, just a lot of countries do a lot better job. I mean, we don't really make parents feel valued for staying home and caring for a child. It's a really devalued thing, which is a big shame.
It is.
But yeah, they're lofty, but good goals. And they're based on evidence, so they are important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Florida, registered family daycare home providers are required to complete 30 hours of training, which are divided into 5 courses. To receive credit, they have to pass an exam on these, too. And they are family child care home rules and regulations, health, safety, and nutrition, identifying and reporting child abuse and neglect, child growth and development, behavioral observation and screening. So Spurgeon, I don't know if she took those courses because she was registered for a while. It might have been before this requirement came into being. But she was registered. It was a licensed home daycare.
She was registered.
Yep.
But we don't know if she ever took those courses.
We don't. No. Now, Maria's family was upset that Stephanie wasn't convicted of murder. Stephanie's supporters believe she's innocent of manslaughter. There is a Facebook page supporting Stephanie called the Stephanie Foundation. When we looked into that, right?
You did.
Okay. And I looked into that. I was using the Royal We.
Okay.
So on the Facebook page, it's this woman, Heather Wood, who's a friend of Stephanie's. And she says that she was convicted of a crime she didn't commit. Their goal is to raise funds to help pay for her appeal process. She says for nearly 18 years, Stephanie ran a state-licensed in-home daycare center in Florida. She was very well respected in her field and was looked upon by the state to act as a mentor to other people starting in-home daycares. In all of the years, Stephanie only had one minor complaint that was investigated and determined to be unfounded. Now, this is the one you were talking about.
Right.
So it really wasn't unfounded. Because there was a witness to it.
There was a witness. The older sister witnessed it.
Right. It just wasn't prosecuted.
Yes.
So in 2008, she says Stephanie took in a new child, the one-year-old Maria, just days prior to coming to Stephanie's house for the day. That girl received several vaccinations. So here we go again, trying to blame vaccinations.
Don't even go there. Who is this woman?
This is Heather Wood, a friend of Stephanie's.
Don't even go there, Heather.
As always, Stephanie carefully documented this child's first day in her house. The child was fussy, wouldn't eat, didn't want to lay down to rest, didn't want to play, and did not want Stephanie to leave her sight. Now, according to Stephanie, for children this young, this is typical in their first day in daycare. She even called the grandmother to let her know the baby was a bit fussy. This isn't what we heard from Maria's family. They called.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about this family. They were very protective of Maria.
They were. And you could even say that Maria was a bit of a spoiled baby.
Yes.
She had to be rocked to sleep. She had to be put into her bed, sound asleep, and she ran the house.
Yeah, and they called and checked on her twice that day.
Yeah, so imagine she's going to daycare on her first day, and there's no mommy or grandma, just this lady, Stephanie Spurgeon.
Oh, I'm sure she would have freaked out.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they also testified that when she got picked up, Stephanie Spurgeon said that she was pissed off, the baby was.
Yeah.
Strange language to use to the grandma.
Absolutely. Well, the one thing about Heather Wood here is her story is different from any story that I've read in any of the documents, the book.
No one else has Heather's story.
Right. So her story was that that afternoon, the grandmother returned to pick up Maria. The baby did not want to get up. But again, as fussy as she'd been earlier, Stephanie didn't find this unusual. Later that evening, the little girl's grandmother called Stephanie and said that she was going to call 911 because the baby was unusually fussy and inconsolable.
This is
not true at all.
No.
She asked if there was anything that happened at Stephanie's that she should tell the paramedics. Stephanie pulled out her daily logging notes and did not see anything out of the ordinary.
There's no such thing as daily logging notes that Stephanie did.
Well, not that we know of.
Right.
Sounds made up to me. The baby was taken to the hospital. The grandmother called later that evening and said everything was fine and they were back home.
Also not true.
This is total bullshit because that child never left.
No.
The hospital. She died in the hospital. Yeah. And then several days later, she was arrested. So it's just crazy.
That's just, yeah. It's a disservice to Stephanie Spurgeon.
They have a Fundly account to try and help with her appeal, but there really isn't much money in it.
I wonder how that's going, because you recall reading that when she was arrested and had the bond hearing and they set her bond, it took over a month for people to raise money to get her out, and she spent Christmas in jail because her good friends couldn't come up with the money.
Well, I mean, maybe they just don't have a lot of money.
Well, I know, but it sounded like there wasn't much of an effort.
Well, I mean, you have this evidence. It's really hard to believe her.
And this woman in the Facebook page talking about raising money, I'm sure that's not going real well.
No, I think there wasn't much money raised yet. So her appellate lawyers are arguing the forensic science that convicted her. Attorneys and scientists alike are challenging forensic science, such as bite mark evidence, hair analysis, and latent fingerprints. Spurgeon's case is part of a handful of child abuse cases being challenged nationwide in light of medical research that shows illness and other factors can cause brain trauma in children, not just abuse. How would you respond to that?
Well, that's a pretty noncommittal statement. Sure, there's other things that can cause brain damage and bleeds.
Right.
But in this particular case, the only thing that caused it was trauma, abusive head trauma.
And it couldn't have been accidental.
No.
Well, they are trying to appeal. She's actually being represented by the Innocence Project of Florida, the Exoneration Project, and the Wisconsin Innocence Project. So a lot of people are really arguing against these head trauma cases, although they do seem to be prosecuted successfully.
They do. And I think if you ask virtually any physician who specializes in child abuse, they will answer you that this is a real diagnosis.
We're not saying that she woke up that morning saying, I want to hurt a child.
No.
No. I mean, these things usually happen when someone just loses their temper.
But she did hurt the child.
Yeah. Did you want to add anything else?
No. I've said enough.
All right.
I'll get crabby.
Don't get crabby. We don't like that. So let's remind people about our contest.
Let's go
to a happier place.
Okay. I'm smiling again.
Okay. So we have a Design a True Crime Brewery t-shirt contest. Looking for a new design from one of our listeners, and that person will win the first t-shirt that's printed, plus $250. Just send us your entry, and you can send it on Instagram, Twitter, or in a Facebook message. You can also email it to truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com. What we want is one of our listeners to do it, because I think listeners understand our certain quirky kind of sense of humor and who we are. So I think that'll be great. We would prefer it in a JPG or PNG format.
So get your entries in.
February 1st is the deadline.
Can I enter, or am I precluded?
You can enter.
Okay. I can judge, though.
You're not a very good artist anyway.
That's true.
You get to judge. That's even more fun.
I can do stick figures.
Yeah, we get to look at them. We've gotten some great ones already.
Yeah, really cool ones.
Yeah.
Although right now we're on differing views as to which one's the best one.
That's true. But that'll all work out
in
the fullness of time.
Yes.
Today's episode was sponsored by Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, the darkly comedic drama from Academy Award winner Martin McDonagh, writer and director of In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths, among other projects. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is a uniquely entertaining tale of revenge and redemption with some of the best actors of our time, Academy Award winners Frances McDormand and Woody Harrelson, along with Sam Rockwell and Peter Dinklage. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is playing in theaters now, and I recommend you go see it. What about Team Tie Grabber? Let's just remind people a little bit about our members-only feed of podcasts.
I think you need to do that, because in my opinion, the latest one about the scuba drowning,
Tina Watson,
was just an excellent recording.
Well, thank you.
And I loved the interview, and I thought that the scuba diver instructor,
Michael McFadden,
was just awesome.
He was great, huh?
He explained things so clearly.
We couldn't have found anyone better, really.
No. So I would join Team Tie Grabber just to get that single episode.
Well, sure, but if you join, you're going to get all of our episodes.
Exactly.
Which there's a pile of them now.
What a deal.
And you'll get a new one every 3 to 4 weeks additionally. Plus, I don't mention very often how much it helps us. I mention the benefits of joining for people, but it really does a lot for us.
That's right. We can buy more beer.
That's right. We can buy better beer and give better reviews. Just having the team, I love it because I figure if someone will take the effort to sign up, then I'm not wasting my time, you know? People are actually enjoying the podcast. Our listeners don't know this about me, but of course you do, Dick. I am always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm a person who's always waiting for something bad to happen. Like, oh, this is too good to be true. So having Team Tie Grabber, I feel like, well, even if our numbers go down or we lose advertisers, I always have these people who really care about the podcast enough to join and sign up and listen. Kind of makes me less nervous about the sky falling down on the podcast. Joining Team Tie Grabber is really easy. Just go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and sign up. You can also sign up to support us on Patreon and listen to these members-only episodes there as a patron of True Crime Brewery. Another way to help us is when you do your holiday shopping. Instead of going straight to Amazon.com, go to tiegrabber.com, click on the Amazon logo, then a percentage of the profits from the things you buy will be sent back to us. So your price will be the same. Everything's the same. We just get a little bit of money back for your purchases.
Well, that'd be a good thing to do.
It's very seamless. It's a great way to give some support to the podcast. We're always accepting feedback, so contact us with your feedback, suggestions, opinions at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, on Twitter @tiegrabberpods, or on our Facebook discussion page, True Crime Brewery Fan Discussions, which is becoming one of my favorite places to visit. Because not only do they talk about our podcast and their opinions, they also bring up some crimes I've never heard of.
It's a good source.
Yeah, we also get people who have personal experience in certain crimes that they want to be addressed, so it's really cool. We really appreciate all of the feedback we get from our listeners. And one final request, if you have a few spare minutes, please give us a review on iTunes and let your friends know about the podcast. That's it for our self-promotion portion. We're going to have a little music, and then we'll get to your feedback.
Feedback's coming. Okay, Jill, you get to lead us off today.
Oh, thanks, Dickie. So my first letter is a case suggestion from Carol, and it's about the disappearance of Danielle Stislicki. So this is from Farmington Hills, Michigan, which is around where my old stomping grounds when I was a kid.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yep. So this was in December 2016. Family members say they suspect foul play as more details are released in the case of missing Farmington Hills woman, Danielle Danny Stislicki. So she's 28 years old. She left her job at MetLife on Telegraph Road, north of 10 Mile in Southfield, at around 5 p.m. and was supposed to stop home and then meet a friend for dinner. However, police say she never showed up for that dinner meeting, didn't make it to work as scheduled the next day, and hasn't been heard from since. So Stislicki's Jeep was found a day later, parked outside her home at the Independence Green Apartments in the area of Halstead and Grand River in Farmington Hills. The vehicle was locked, police said, and Stislicki's purse, along with her ID and credit cards, were found inside. Police said they found no signs of a struggle. Speaking at a news conference, Stislicki's mother and father said it was out of character for her to disappear like this, that she's normally dependable, and there was no way that she would just up and leave without leaving word for them. So her mom suspects that she was abducted. She says, "Our concern is that Danielle is somewhere being held, not by her choice, and wants to come home. We want to bring her home. The way you can help is to help spread this across the world. Spread this to your family, coworkers, talk about it. I ask you, I plead as a family, as a mother, from the deepest of my heart, help us bring Danielle home. There's a huge community out there that Danielle belongs to, and we need to go ahead and bring her home. Anyone who may have been in the area of Stislicki's workplace or her apartment early Friday evening is asked to try to recall if they spotted her vehicle. It's a dark gray Jeep Renegade, mud-covered on the bottom half. Also, was she alone in the vehicle if you did see her? And in what state did she appear? Investigators want to speak to anyone who may have seen Stislicki and or her Jeep leaving the MetLife office on December 2nd. Anyone who may have seen Stislicki and or her Jeep arriving at her apartment complex between 5 p.m. on December 2nd and 6 p.m. December 3rd. Police are also looking for Stislicki's keys with a distinctive key charm, a smiling yellow figure with a green body and yellow legs, as well as her cell phone, a Samsung Galaxy Core Prime phone in a rose-colored case. Now, she's described as 5 feet 5 inches tall, 123 pounds, with brown wavy medium-length hair. She was wearing jeans, a black zip-up shirt, a sky blue Eddie Bauer 3-in-1 jacket, and burgundy boots. She has no known mental health issues. A cash reward raised via GoFundMe for information leading to her whereabouts is up to over $16,000. In addition, a $50,000 reward is being offered by Independence Green Apartments upon the safe return of Danielle, and an arrest and conviction if illegal activity was involved. About a dozen law enforcement agencies, including the FBI and Secret Service, are now involved in this investigation. So this is a very recent case.
I guess, although not so recent that I would presume is the better word. She's probably not alive.
Well, statistics would say no.
Right, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a good case suggestion. So thank you, Carol. We'll definitely keep an eye on that case.
Okay, and I'm going to do just a comment. I have another case. I have a case to discuss too, but I'm saving that one. This is from James, talking about an inconvenient woman, one of our more recent ones that we've done.
Yeah, I think that was our most recent. It's about the murder of Carol Kennedy down in Arizona.
Right, most recent.
Yeah.
October of 2016, Steve DeMocker's appeal was denied. His conviction and sentence were affirmed. And James also writes, it should also be noted that at the time of his sentencing, he was fined. He is required to pay $700,000 in restitution to a victim fund. So while his daughters, at least one says she believes in his innocence and the other one has not publicly said, funneled the money from the insurance to his defense, the courts are requiring that it be returned.
How will that happen, though?
But he's destitute.
I think so.
But anyway, so James goes on, "This is a tough case for me. I do have a strong feeling that he was responsible for the death of his wife, but I am not sure if it was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I worry when cases are won for the prosecution when there is little evidence other than behaviors before and after a murder. It sets a precedence among courts to continue to allow possibly insignificant things into the trials. Precedence is the foundation of our justice system. For me, this case might have opened a door that will allow innocent people to be convicted of crimes. Well, I agree it's a tough case, and we both think that he was responsible for the death of his wife. And it might not have been beyond a reasonable doubt, but I think that there was enough evidence, circumstantial evidence, that truly pointed to him. I don't think there's a worry that we're setting a precedent to allow insignificant events into the trials.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was enough at the time to convict him, but right. I could see where some of the things probably didn't need to be brought into court. Like, wasn't some of his infidelity beforehand brought in? I'm trying to remember.
I'm not sure that was.
But
I'm just looking at the discrepancies in his stories, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I think those are valid.
And that's what I was thinking about. I mean, discrepancies and just lies.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
I think he did it.
Sure.
And I'm not too concerned that we're setting a precedence.
Well, you remember Drew Peterson's wife, Stacy, who went missing, and they changed the law. I think they called it Drew's Law, where they were allowed to bring in secondhand information, which would have normally been hearsay.
Yeah.
And they changed the law so you could bring that in if someone wasn't able to speak for themselves. So That's a little bit scary. I mean, I'm glad that he got convicted, but he got convicted on
his other wife that he killed.
Yeah, his other wife that he killed.
So anyway. I'm gonna give you one, and this is from Haley S. She wants to know, does anyone know who Kaylee Anthony's father is?
Yeah, so oddly enough, we don't really know. And I guess I was under the impression that some DNA testing or something had been done and they knew. But I guess it's not known, at least not to the public.
So what do we know?
Well, we know that there have been several men that have come forward or been named as possible fathers, so we can go through the possibilities. There's a few. We've got Jesus Ortez. Shortly after Kaylee went missing, her maternal grandma, Cindy Anthony, told the media that Kaylee's father was in a terrible car accident and was deceased. And one person fit the bill. This was 21-year-old Jesus Ortiz, who Casey had casually dated before he died in 2007. Now, Casey herself told friends that her former high school classmate was the father of Kaylee. When his family heard the news, they were shocked, since they claim Casey never hinted at that possibility that he had fathered her child until after she entered the public eye because of Kaylee's disappearance. Miss Anthony never told the family Jesus was the father or that he might be the father, the family said in a statement. In fact, the family has never met her and does not know her. So I guess that one's not super likely.
Doesn't sound like it.
Now, there's also a colleague named Josh. A woman named Melina Calabrese, a friend of Casey, testified that Casey confided in her that she became pregnant after having a one-night stand with a man named Josh, who worked at Universal Studios alongside Casey. Now, according to Casey's friend, he also died in a car crash in 2007. Of course, it was later revealed that Casey was lying to police about working at Universal Studios at the time Kaylee was conceived, so that one probably isn't very likely either.
Probably not.
But just Casey Anthony is such a liar, it's,
well, and it's
unbelievable.
It's tough. She was quite the party girl.
That's true, too.
So it might be, not casting too many aspersions on her, it might be that she just doesn't know who the father is.
Yeah. Well, we know that Jesse Grund isn't. Now, he was once engaged to Casey, and during a lot of her pregnancy and all of Kaylee's life, he had assumed the role of father after Casey told him the baby was his, even though the timing of the conception didn't quite line up with their relationship. But eventually, a DNA test confirmed that he was not the father. Other suggestions are Lee Anthony, her brother. During the trial, Casey's brother was brought on the stand to testify and had to submit a DNA test to confirm that he wasn't the child's father. Fortunately, the DNA test confirmed he was not, so we know it wasn't her brother.
Okay.
Now, Casey's defense attorney, Jose Baez, also had Casey's own father submit a DNA test to prove he didn't father Kaylee after making the allegations that he was sexually assaulting his daughter. So we also have a confirmed test that it wasn't George. One other possibility was Michael Dugan. Perhaps the least likely candidate was this young man who died in a car accident in 2007. His mother, Donna, came forward during this media circus surrounding Casey's murder trial to say that prior to Michael's death, her son confided in her that he had a daughter with Casey. So while no one's responded to these allegations, she has told the Daily Beast that she was 100% certain Kaylee is her granddaughter. Now, as far as I know, there was no testing done on that. I guess at this point, though, it'd probably be too late to do DNA testing. And it really doesn't matter, I guess.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I guess people would like to know who fathered the child.
But... yeah, but we know that it wasn't the guy she said it was, and we know that it wasn't any of her family members.
Right.
That's all I got for you on that.
Okay, that's plenty. We got a lot of no's.
Yes. So the answer is no, we don't know who the father of Kaylee
was. The short
was.
Answer is no, we don't know. I have a case suggestion from Jessica M. I'm going to beg you again for the Missy Beavers case. She says, come on, Dick, since it's Texas, you can do a beer called Vulgar Display of Power, which is what this killer showed, by Brash Brewing Company. We've had done a beer by Brash. I forget which one, but that was in another Texas episode.
Okay, but you haven't done that one. I think I would have remembered that.
No, I haven't done Vulgar Display of Power. So Jessica says, it's still a cold case, but I have my suspicions. So we have this Reddit summary from Unsolved Mysteries. On April 18th, 2016, 45-year-old fitness instructor Terry Beavers, who often went by the name Missy, was brutally murdered inside Creekside Church, located in Midlothian, Texas, in the early hours of the morning. At the time, she was getting preparations ready for a fitness class, Camp Gladiator, which she taught. This was before her students were to arrive at 5 in the morning. Once class was about to begin, her students discovered her lifeless body. Her death was caused by puncture wounds to the head and chest. So as the investigation went underway, the police discovered surveillance footage that was inside the church with the murder suspect dressed in SWAT gear. He or she was dressed to the nines, vest, pants, boots, and a helmet, even with a hammer that was probably used for Missy's murder. Now, this is where things become peculiar. Whoever this person of interest is, they had a very unorthodox and unnatural posture and stance, especially when walking aimlessly. So they don't know whether this was intentional or not. Nevertheless, the footage did allow the police to build a timeline of events. Surveillance shows the suspect inside walking around casually and opening the many doors. Not only that, this incident took place at approximately 4:15 in the morning, just 45 minutes before her class was supposed to start, and presumed to be male, but police are still unsure of the gender of this individual. So subsequently, investigators started to look into Missy's personal life. They used search warrants, and they were able to find some possible motives. She was a mother of 3 kids and was having a lot of troubles financially and with her marriage, especially on her part with unfaithfulness. Texts and other forms of messages found her being flirtatious with another male or males. With that being uncovered, police finally had their biggest break. Yet, unfortunately, that avenue didn't provide any substantial clues. Missy's husband, Brandon, told police he strongly believes that the murderer is a female and knew her on some form of personal basis. Furthermore, he suggests that this unidentified woman attempted to make this tragedy look like a burglary gone wrong, mainly due to surveillance showing this individual opening doors and breaking glass windows.
So this person didn't know they were on tape, obviously.
Right. Now, the strangeness in this case doesn't stop here. A few days after the murder, Missy's father-in-law, Randy Beavers, went to the dry cleaners, bringing in a woman's XXL long-sleeve T-shirt covered with blood. He told the employees that it was merely from a Chihuahua dog that was injured and taken to a vet. Out of suspicion, the employees at the dry cleaner contacted the police, and the shirt was subjected to DNA testing. Nonetheless, the vet was able to confirm this incident. Though the shirt became ruled out, investigators still had their eyes on Randy. More interestingly, Randy, the father-in-law, is roughly the same height and weight of the stranger captured on surveillance. While this crime was making its coverage on various television news channels, the family of Missy was brought into the public eye. During one particular broadcast, the father-in-law was interviewed. As such, many people noticed that his demeanor was slightly different in terms of emotion. Not only that, the way Randy walked was practically identical to the person of interest in the surveillance footage. Remember, they were talking about some unnatural
gait. Yeah.
8 months have passed, and despite all this information, the case is still unsolved. Missy's murderer is still free.
Okay.
Jessica says that she thinks this case deserves a lot more attention than it's been receiving. Whether the killer is a male or female, I cannot say for certain. That being said, in my eyes, this should be solvable. I can't fathom the notion of this simply being an act of sheer randomness. To me, it was methodical, deliberate, and personal, with the killer knowing Missy on a level of friendship or simply acquaintances in one way or another. This unidentified person had an idea of Missy's schedule and planned the attack accordingly. I'm hopeful this case will be solved soon. Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's worth a second look, huh?
Definitely
is. Sounds pretty crazy.
It does. And the part I know, we haven't really researched it. This is just what we've read.
Right.
But if you've got this person on video who is the same size and walks the same way as the father-in-law, wouldn't you think you'd be putting a lot more pressure on this guy?
Yeah, but I mean, we don't know what's going on. They might be interviewing him.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to say because it sounds crazy.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the feedback. Short feedback segment today.
I don't have any more.
Well, everybody have a nice Thanksgiving if you're in the U.S.
Or is it Canada? When do they
celebrate? Canada already had theirs in October, I think.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So U.S. people.
Yeah.
And territories.
Right.
U.S. territories.
Sure.
And Black Friday after Thanksgiving. The alcohol kind, not the shopping kind.
So I guess Black Friday is a good time for people to drink dark beers.
Yes, it is. I will be.
All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Thanks, guys.
And we will see you
at the quiet end.
Bye-bye.